When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Hello and welcome to the final watch along of Sunderland Till I Die. There have been thrills, trials and tribulations, the latter mostly for me doing the edits late at night. But it feels a bit of a seminal moment as the lockdown sadly continues and we stay alert, at least in the UK anyway. As I say every week, if you've tuned in for the first time in a while, this is an FPL free zone. So if you're new here, please stop listening to this and go back to episode one of the series, starting off at 18 minutes, 30 seconds in to get you up to speed and get through this whole kind of series. But for those still with us, let's get into it. I'm joined today by Nick and Stag, of course. Nick, you all right?
Hey mate, yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's another week in lockdown, feels all the same, even if the government are starting to relax the measures a little bit. It all feels very samey for myself, at least. Staying at home, I can't see myself actually going back to the office for at least another few months, so, or until even a vaccine comes out. But you know, enjoying life at least in lockdown with my kid and my family, it's not too bad. But yeah, everything's okay, thanks. Who we are Who Got the Assist. You can find us on Twitter at @WGTA_FPL for Tom, at @WGTA_Nick for myself, at @FPLStag for Anthony, and we're also on Instagram, so make sure to give us a follow there, WGTA.FPL. So Anthony, what's the pod this week?
Evening lads, staying alert here in Brussels too at the moment. This week, so we're going to be looking at the whole entire project restart in the Premier League in June, how that's coming along, all the different roadblocks that seem to be almost regenerating and generating themselves constantly. With the Bundesliga as well nearing its approach, there's been big news there in terms of the Dynamo Dresden team being gone into full quarantine, which has obviously put a little bit of a problem there for them and whether it's even going to go ahead in the next week or two. And then we've also got more Kyle Walker news before we eventually move on to our Sunderland Till I Die watch along for the final episode of this series.
Cool, yeah. More Kyle Walker news. I think we're saying off camera, we've got to include it every week. He is to these podcasts what Nicola Gaetan is to Manchester United transfer windows. Is just an ever-present, isn't he? But let's go to the news. And, you know, we've been staying alert this week to news in terms of the restart because it does seem like it's edging ever closer. The Premier League, it's still up in the air. We'll talk about it in a second. But one thing that which is, at the time of recording, fairly certain, is that the Bundesliga, that's the German league for those people who don't speak German, is back this weekend. As Stag just mentioned, the Dynamo Dresden, who I think are in the championship equivalent of the Bundesliga.
Bundesliga 2,
two, for those people who aren't German speakers. They're about to go into, they've gone into quarantine, haven't they? So, is it a farce?
Well, so the Bundesliga CEO has said that it's definitely still going ahead regardless of the Dynamo Dresden news. Christian Seifert said, we're not changing our plans, everything is continuing on, but with Dynamo Dresden, they're not going to be able to play any games at least until the 26th, 27th of May. So there's still going to be some fixtures cancelled, and a few cynical minds out there as well seems saying that it's all a ploy, considering Dynamo Dresden are bottom of the table, looking like they're going to be relegated, and probably looking to see if they can get that league cancelled. But that's obviously a very cynical mindset towards what's going on in the Bundesliga. But at the moment, they're still going ahead. Seems like it's going to be starting next weekend, which is great for us that have missed the football, like the fantasy. We're also playing a little bit of fantasy Bundesliga as well. So if you guys on Twitter having some chat about that, and that looks like it might be a bit of fun on the side. But yeah, you know, Germany have managed this epidemic a lot better than some other European countries, including ourselves. So if they're ready to play football, then they're ready. But still a little bit of wait and see, I guess. Could be cancelled last minute, possibly.
It goes back to something we discussed a few weeks ago, where the whole entire house of cards completely collapse once one player tests positive. You know, whole teams have to go into lockdown. That's fixtures cancelled for at least 2 weeks. If you're playing midweek matches, or if it's like what La Liga plan to do, you could quite easily miss 3 or 4 fixtures for your team if the whole team has to go into quarantine. Like, the fact of the matter is if the whole squad are together and somebody tests positive in the days following that, all of them are going into quarantine. And if they've played a game, the opposition are going into quarantine. And it's just so difficult to try and keep this whole entire thing balancing on a knife edge over the course of so many weeks, and there's all the other impossible situations that go with it. Of course, it will be nice to have a fantasy football thing going again with the FBL that, as Nick mentioned, quite a few people are taking a bit of an interest in, and you're starting to see the introduction to the Bundesliga articles appearing around Twitter and in The Athletic and places like that, which is kind of funny. And I for one do indeed look forward to getting to know Schalke's left back and the like. But
yeah, exactly. Cheering on Nkunku and co is going to be great fun. Don't know if we're doing anything for FBL. We'll have a think about it. But in the meantime, it'll be good to see top level football back. It's not knocking the South Korean League or the Belarusian Premier League. But yeah, it'll be, I think that's the first kind of affected Western big six league to come back, isn't it? So yeah, really interesting. And I guess on the other side of it, though, remember, they've shown their hand, and it looks like with the Premier League, Project Restart that we spoke about last week has been hitting a whole load of barriers, as Anthony mentioned a little while ago. As lower tier clubs have dug into opposition to the neutral venues idea, and it looks like some news has just come out tonight on that one too. And yeah, there's also a few players already kind of putting the biosphere in danger. So Brighton, an unnamed player, has gone into quarantine. Youch. And Dean Smith as well said that 3 players of his team either are suffering from something themselves or have underlying health conditions at home with their families that they may not play. So quite a hairy situation in general, isn't it?
Definitely. I think, it's just the cynic comes to play when you look at some of the teams that seem to be most actively remonstrating online. We've seen tweets from the likes of Tyrone Mings tonight, you know, complaining and also highlighting that, you know, it's not about the positions of the league, but it's, you know, everyone's concerned about health and health is the priority. And of course, health is the priority. But you've also seen other people like Todd Cantwell also tweet about Project Restart. And as you mentioned, the Brighton, another team that potentially are in a lot of danger in terms of relegation with their players in quarantine. And at the end of the day, safety is paramount, and we've also noticed, you know, like there's going to be huge bills for these clubs if the matches aren't played, and there's potentially even huge bills anyway in regards to missed broadcaster rights for the games that have already been missed this season. So there's a lot of money in getting the league restarted, and a lot of people are very keen to get started, but then it's that old age question against economy versus health. And at the moment, 1st of June has been mooted as the threshold in terms of deadline from which games can be played again, and that's for now.
So just to put a little bit of meat on the bones of what Nick was speaking about with regards to the broadcaster's bill, that even if games do go ahead, it's looks like that the clubs could still have to, I guess, not get £300 million or £350 million worth of money from the broadcasters for this season. And that basically boils down to the fact that they can't fulfil some of the obligations in the broadcast contracts, most notably the fact that when the games are likely to start and, I guess, finish is, you know, starting in mid-June and then sometime towards the end of the summer that they would finish, so they missed the allotted time slot that they had. And then the fact that there are no fans there, I guess, I'm not sure what particular contractual obligation there was regarding fans there or the atmosphere, but they're certainly not going to be able to meet that, whatever it is. Which is, of course, naturally leading some clubs to wonder, like, okay, if we're financially screwed anyway, even if we do play, damned if we do, damned if we don't, isn't the easiest option and the healthiest option to do is just not to play whatsoever? So yeah, like when you hope to spread all these games over 7 weekends and 2 midweeks with staggered kickoffs times, it's going to be a logistical nightmare. It's going to be a nightmare from a health point of view. From a PR perspective, it's going to be extremely difficult. And if somebody, God forbid, is seriously injured or goes onto a ventilator, and that doesn't just include players, that includes backroom staff as well. And we know some of those are as old as in their 70s. things are going to get a lot more difficult.
No, they certainly are. I think that it's a question of momentum now, isn't it? It's a question of how things develop over the next few days. You've got Greg Clark, who's the FA chairman, who said today that the governing body will not sanction no relegation or voiding the season. So the null and voiders are going to have to go and do something else. And you've had 5 shareholders meetings since play was suspended in March to try to figure out what's going on, what they're going to do about everything. And plans are still fairly incomplete, but it does look like once they've got everybody to agree to something, they'll be able to push through it. It's just about trying to get that agreement. As you spoke about last week, as Nick just mentioned, the 6 clubs at the bottom are all clubs who have said, no, I'm not going to play at a neutral venue. So it is looking like they are going to have to do the home and away. And that does unleash a plethora of issues, but equally it may be the only way that they can get things sorted out. Like the return to training protocols are probably what's going to be sorted out first, and then kind of when they get to games, it'll be like that kind of, they'll do that first stage of training, then the second stage is going to be how we kind of bridge the gap between training to making games happen. And it may well be we have a La Liga sort of approach where games get smashed out really, really quickly just to get the season finished. Oh, it's a minefield, isn't it? And there's always legal and financial implications as well. But for whatever reason, it looks like we are going towards getting the season finished. It's just kind of a case of when rather than if now.
You kind of feel it's almost like you're reluctantly hanging someone for a crime you're not sure they've committed, though. You know, they're just forcing themselves to finish this season. And I think there's everybody at this point seems to have doubts about it. I think when we first started doing these podcasts at home, it kind of felt like, sure, they can restart it. Like, of course they can at some point. And I definitely was blithely kind of expecting, like, of course it'll be easy to do it eventually. But just the more you watch, the more difficulties become apparent. And it's all the different facets of the arguments that lower clubs and upper clubs and health concerns and who people live with and who they don't live with and for how long that they would have to live these really weird lives and whether they'd have to live those weird lives next season too and whether even next season would be able to go ahead if they can't do this season. It continues.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like we're going around in circles. And speaking of which, I found a man this week to talk about, Carl Walker. Run circles again, he's back. But should we be getting a tiny violin out for him? He's gone round circles because he's circled back to Sheffield, circled back to the North East to see his family, and now he's complaining that he's been hounded. Malachi Clerkin in the Irish Times and Dan Taylor in the Athletic think that we probably shouldn't be getting on tiny violins and actually just thinking, you know what, Carl, you're a bit of an idiot. What do you guys think?
Like, I would have read that Malachi Clerkin piece in the Times, and I definitely would agree with his perspective on things, that Kyle Walker came out with this. It wasn't an apology. It was just a complete and utter, almost, it wasn't an attack on the media in the Trump sense of the word. But at the same time, what you had from Walker was completely failing to understand why what he did was an issue and why the rules don't apply differently to him because he's a footballer or because he was feeling sad or because whatever. There's so many people in probably much worse situations than him. Everyone is missing out on things. People aren't having funerals. People have lost their jobs and don't have a stellar income. People are missing birthdays. That was one of the things that was thrown into his list. Yep. Grow up, Kyle.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're all agreed here. he came out and attacked the media for this sort of breach of privacy, and you know, his sister hugged him. What was he to do that his sister hugged him? And he got some hot meals from his parents, and didn't even mention the fact that he'd also gone for a bike ride with a friend. That was left out of his note, probably because there was no excuse to that particular one. And you know, this whole breach of privacy and all this stuff. But you know, he is in the public eye, and it wasn't so much about what he did on this particular incident, the previous incident with the sex worker that everyone knows about, and you know, he's not going to be living down anytime soon. And I think at this point it probably would have been best if he just shut up and just stayed indoors, and just, you know, rather than trying to attack the media. It came up completely wrong.
Absolutely. A bit amusing, but there we go. All right, let's take a break there, and we'll get into Season 2, Episode 6, the final episode of Sunderland Slide Eye, and that we're going to be watching along. There is one more to come after this, though, and it's called Football is Life.
Who got the assist?
So we're back, and it's the end of this Series 2 of Sunderland Eye, Football is Life. It's 52 minutes to round off the season as we fade to black at the end of the series. We're not going to talk too much about grand themes on this one. It's more about the episode itself. In terms of grand themes next week, shock reveal, we've got Alex McCain, the host of the Roker Report, joining us next week to talk about the season as a whole, kind of how they saw it as fans, and also kind of to provide a little bit of an epilogue. Where are they now, all these main characters? What are the perspectives on these guys? How have they evolved since the show was filmed? And what's happened since the Sunderland, our beloved Sunderland, who we leave at the very end of this episode? But, you know, this episode kicks off in Easter. There's chat about the buzz in the city right off the bat. And it's reminiscent of the very opening of Sunderland Till I Die, the very first episode. You see the priests, they watch the top of the hill, some prayers and stuff. And they say prayers for the people, the city, and of course, the football club.
Because of the hope and belief of our supporters, we dare to dream.
The opening credits then roll for the final time in this series.
On the river where they used to build the boats.
And we open with the game. It's 13th of April, Sunderland versus Coventry, and it's 3-3. Stuart and Charlie in the executive lounge, they're ripped apart. They're saying huge gaps exist between the players, but the goals did come in the second half. Long and short of it, it's 5-4, a 5-4 defeat at home, no less, their first home defeat of the season. Charlie reaches for some grandiose metaphors to describe the defending, and Jack Ross agrees.
The brutal truth about today is you can't defend in that manner against a good team and expect to win games. How we defended is just miles away from where it needs to be at.
And yeah, it looks like kind of Baldwin and Flanagan, the two centre-backs, are being really singled out for criticism particularly. And we hear from Tom Flanagan first, one of the centre-halves, who said he's been verbally abused in Tesco of his wife and newborn baby.
They're looking at you like you're not even trying. And you're thinking, well, actually, like, I am trying, so it's difficult.
And I think this is quite worrying, isn't it? Because we saw, like, last season, with the Chris Coleman incident, for example, that things do turn nasty, and it has happened a few times where they've been kind of paying lip service to it, where if the fans turn, things can turn a little bit kind of pressurised. But I mean, listen to Tom Flanagan and him saying his wife and newborn baby were set upon to some extent. You've got to ask, where is the line? Like, what do you guys think about seeing that?
I was upset with it in the way that Flanagan painted the image anyway, which was certainly that he was accosted and it was very unfair and quite aggressive. It was kind of the picture he painted of this, you know, approach in Tesco, let's say. So it goes two ways in that I don't like this idea that players should never be spoken to in public by people. I think it's great that people are able to see players on the streets and ask them for selfies or even just speak to them about the football briefly. It might drive the player mad, but I think that's part of the job, is being recognised and having to talk to fans. And just, you know, look, even at League One, you get a decent pay in most cases. And I think that's just part of what you're paid for, is the really annoying side of being recognized on the streets. But the line is, of course, at verbal abuse and even being overly critical to somebody's face. Like, you can't go up to Flanagan and say these sort of things. Like, do you really not think that Flanagan himself knows that he had a nightmare the week before? He's conceded 5 goals at home. Like, the whole stadium's already been abusing him, and we'll talk about that later and whether that's okay. His teammates know it. The management have definitely abused him, and he himself is going to give out to himself too. You know, someone doesn't need to come up to you in Tesco to make you finally know that you've had a bad game.
Yeah, exactly. That's not right. To be like abusing players to their faces, especially when they're just trying to go about their business, to go about their living, you know, with young families, it's just ultimately unacceptable. And to a certain extent, you can take that off real life as well and talk about some of the online abuse that some of the players get as well. It borders on like offensive. It's horrendous, you know. So I think I remember seeing on the Leeds documentary, there was Luke Ireland used to talk about how he was searching for his name on Twitter, or his wife had searched for his name. You know, you'd just be tweets upon tweets, just, you know, horrendously berating him and abusing him with, you know, all sorts and death threats and things like that and thrown in as well. And, you know, that is absolutely horrendous and unacceptable. I strongly condemn that behaviour, obviously, because that's just unacceptable, isn't it?
Okay, so Tom, if you see Mustafi down in Tesco, or Nick, if you see, I don't know, Jose Mourinho perhaps down in Tesco,
Eric Dyer,
or Eric Dyer, what is it that you're going to say? Like, do you, what do you think is acceptable to say? Do you think it's not even okay to ask them for a picture or to take a photo of them for Twitter or something? What, like, what's okay? What's not okay? And if you want to give a piece of your mind, what's okay?
I think it's just being respectful to another human being at the end of the day. Like, I think that's literally all it is. And it's almost like it's a case of not what you say, but the way you say it. I know that sounds a bit flappy, but at the same time, it's completely true, because you don't want to be in the situation, like, as a human being, that someone else is coming up to you and having a go at you for something you did in the office. Like, if Nick, someone came up to you and was just like, oh, you that last email is absolutely fucking dreadful, mate. God, what have you done? That you missed a full stop there. Like, you'd be like, what, really? Like, come on, seriously. Like, you just wouldn't expect that behavior, and you wouldn't ever interact with somebody like that. So why is it acceptable to speak to somebody like that, even if they are like a little bit of a celebrity or they do play football? Like, I just don't really think that that's fair. I think what is fair is to criticize someone professionally, but you have to be very careful about separating the person from the professional, and that can be really, really hard to do, especially if the receiver of the criticism runs the risk of taking that personally. Like, sometimes you have to be very, very clear about how you're doing it. But in terms of, if I saw a footballer like Mustafi in real life, like, me personally, I would just leave them be. I wouldn't go up to them or anything like that, because that's not who I am. I mean, the first I go is ask them for a photo or something. But, like, you know, I just take the view that I can't really criticize them, because I can criticize them as footballers, like, as statistical entities that I analyze, but as people and, like, being abused to somebody, that's just not in my makeup. It's not my character. So, you know, there's definitely a line to be drawn for me, and I think that probably is it, that it's just being respectful if I have criticism, or, you know, just trying to treat them as professional entities rather than people.
Exactly. And you know, we've obviously, as podcasters, we've received abuse online before as well, you know, not to the extent that footballers have received. We've received marginal abuse, and we don't like it when we receive it. So and no one obviously likes being abused or being attacked. So if you don't like it, you know, being received yourself, then why would you dish it out, you know? So I think it's obviously unacceptable, and, you know, especially the incident that's described in the series where he's kind of accosted in Tesco after losing the game. Obviously, he put his best, you know, he's put his effort in.
I think the difference is there, Nick, is that, like, none of us are match-going fans, none of us are tribal fans, and the three of us, I think, are fairly individualistic characters, whereas those who are regular match-goers and are people who, I guess, are used to their identity being subsumed by a wider whole, and identify as being part of a group. Like, I'm a fan, whereas I don't think any of us would probably say we're tribal fans in that way. There's no, like, kind of emotion which overrules our rational thought. Like, can we understand the view of somebody who gets caught up in emotion, goes to games the whole time? Like, do you think that they do have a right to turn around and say what they want because they pay their money to go and see their hard-earned cash to go and see somebody like Tom Flanagan play and him performing badly?
So I guess whilst I'm not a tribal fan, as we put it, or even a constant match goer, I think I would be that when it comes to maybe Republic of Ireland football games, and that I try to get to every single one of them. And I, you know, at that point, I'm definitely only supporting Ireland, and I don't have a vague love for Oman or Georgia or whoever, Ireland or Denmark, because we were always playing those three teams, it seems. But I can understand the tribalism in that sense, and that wanting that sense of belonging. And I love the kind of escapism of going there, you know, you forget about the individualisticness of myself for a while and just be of the group. And that is lovely. But what I don't understand is how some people allow or think that it's okay for that to manifest itself as just being a bad person and just hurling abuse at a player, a manager, a referee. Like, it's fine to be exasperated. It's fine to say, oh, F this, you know, like, or just to yourself. It's another thing to get up from your chair, point at somebody and scream, you're a whatever the hell. Yeah. That's not okay for me.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a very fine line. I mean, we've all been in situations where we've been watching TV on the television and you might have shouted or hurled some abuse, but the player's not necessarily listening. Or, well, yeah, obviously not listening if they're watching the television, but if you're in the crowd as well, you might have shouted stuff and you're almost kind of firing up the player, trying to get them to, you know, perform better, you know, put your effort in. If you're at an Arsenal game, for instance, you see Ozil languidly wandering around, not tracking back and helping the team defend, then of course you're going to say, get the F back there and help the team and stuff like that. And I think that's, you know, there are limits to it. Obviously, you know, some circumstances, the crowd trying to fire up the team and, you know, the home advantage, getting everyone involved. But, you know, just shouting pure abuse, that's doesn't hold any benefit other than to kind of make the player, you know, upset is obviously unacceptable.
Like, you see, every club has this to an extent, I'm fully aware, but there are some clubs, your Millwalls, your West Hams, and I think your Sunderlands as well, where the fans seem to revel in the idea that they're going to be tough on their players because that's how much they care about the game, and it's, you know, they'll shroud misbehavior and completely forgetting about what's okay and what's not okay in passion, and I'm doing a quotation marks here. and I think that there's a need to get a grip and be accountable for what you're doing at some stage, and not just to think, you know, oh, we just love the game and so it's carte blanche, okay, to say absolutely anything, and trying to write it off as if, you know, Luke O'Neill knew what he was getting into when he signed for Sunderland. No, yeah. Like, Luke O'Neill doesn't need to be denigrated every game for missing his touch or whatever.
Oh, who'd denigrate Luke O'Neill though? I'd be there to beat him up if he did that. Dear me, what a lovely man. But yeah, no, there are shades of, you know, all of Liverpool fans back in Luis Suarez when he was clearly found by the Evra inquiry to be a bit of a racist. But yeah, I mean, everything you've just spoken about, if I imagine putting this in front of certain people I know on Twitter, for example, and them thinking, oh, you know, what a bunch of softs you all are. I mean, are we all that's wrong with football? Like, we're just armchair fans of this at this point, maybe passing comment on a reality we don't experience. I mean, do you think that's a fair cop?
Maybe not, like, I sit down to discuss why I think that, you know, why these people want to listen to these people who might think that this behavior is okay, and to discuss it with them and go into detail. Like, maybe they don't exactly want to have such, you know, enlightened arguments or discussions about these sort of things either, and they're right and I'm wrong and that's that.
Maybe.
Like, you know, but what I'm trying to get at is that siloization of society. So it is kind of difficult for us to maybe empathize with these other people, but at the end of the day, I guess I have my own moral compass. You guys do too, and they seem to be largely aligned on this particular aspect of things. And yeah, I think it's okay.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think that, like, even though we're not match-going fans, and I think sometimes he who shouts loudest gets a lot of the airtime, but, like, our views are valid, I think, too, because it provides different perspective. Like, if you remove this kind of assumption that it has to be a right and wrong, and this kind of dumb heuristic that you can't hold two ideas simultaneously, I think you can have a view as a match-going fan, but that's also very subjective. So you can temper it with something like, you know, more distance and analytical view, such as the one that we provide for this and maybe for FPL as well. And both do go together. And it doesn't have to be a case of right and wrong and that sort of reductivism there. Maybe it's just me, but I'm glad that you guys look like you're nodding along.
Yeah, but when it comes to, like, armchair fans as a general thing, you know, some people would just criticize anybody who comments on anything. It's like, oh, you were never a professional footballer, you don't understand, or you're not a match-going fan, you don't understand. Like, the fact of the matter is that a good solid 90-something% of life and discussion is passing comment on the reality that you don't experience, be that the House of Commons, be that Love Island, be that who Kyle Walker is visiting or had visiting his home. And so it's like that argument is null and void as far as I'm concerned.
No, I can get that. I can get behind that as well. It's just trying to play devil's advocate to some extent, just to kind of address what may be going through people's minds, or at least, like, if we did kind of fueled that discussion on social media, how it would turn out, I guess. Yeah, no, interesting. Right, so that debate over, and we see Jack Ross in the training ground explaining how making choices is tough and sometimes you disappoint players. We finally hear from Jack Baldwin at his home. It's our second visit there, actually. We went there at the very start of episode 2, and he's saying he's been left out.
The house is to let.
Oh yeah, so it looks like he might not be there for much longer. Good spot.
I was really interested to see that. I was like, when I first saw that to let sign, I was like, oh, where's this going? Is he leaving the club after this bad performance? No, not this.
Maybe
time.
He's upgrading.
Or downgrading to a bungalow. But yeah, I mean, either way, he says the Coventry game wasn't good enough.
I got left out for the good of the football club. I have to accept that, because if I went in and made a mistake and we messed up or whatever, then I wouldn't be able to live with myself.
And yeah, it doesn't sound very good. We'll get to him in a minute. But we also see our Disney prince, Luke O'Neill, getting a haircut. He lays it out. They can still get the top two, but it's broadly out of their hands, really. It cuts Charlie in the car, and he's saying he's hoping that this be the moment that things change.
I'm going to match his thinking. I hope that today is the day when we turn a corner and start playing well again.
It's a huge game. Jack Baldwin's wife segues us in nicely, talking about how he's reacted to being left out. There's the scene in the players' lounge before. And yeah, she says he's very low.
They do say, don't they, there's a lot of depression in football. It weighs heavily on your mental health. I do genuinely believe that. And before Jack played football, I never would have understood it, that actually people do suffer really bad.
Similar to Tom Flanagan, it's not very nice to see. And I guess it's part and parcel of being a footballer. But no, she has raised the D word there, which is a little bit different. Normally, you just like, oh, he's down. You know, he's mentally not in a good place. But actually, saying, you know, he's a bit depressed. That's kind of almost worrying, isn't it? I mean, is there a place for this in that kind of in this sort of macho world of football, or is it kind of a new age snowflakey thing to be even pulling up here and talking about it?
It's certainly not a new agey, slow, fakey thing, at least in my opinion. I think it's a very serious matter and something that we obviously needs more attention and started to get some more attention that it actually deserves. I mean, many players have sort of spoken out in recent years about depression. Obviously, we had the horrendous story with Gary Speed as well, you know, losing his life to depression and his battle with depression. No one really knew that was the case with him. So it's something that does need attention and is concerning. We also saw it with Johnny Williams, who made a cameo in this episode last season, talking about some of his mental health issues. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, footballers, again, it links very nicely with our topic of discussion just a minute ago, where we were talking about the abuse that players get online and how that can have an impact on your mental health. And, you know, you do need to, it does need to be taken into consideration. And hopefully, you know, mental health is starting to get the attention it deserves when previously it probably didn't and was something that was considered, oh, you know, you're a man, you're a footballer, you know, we don't deal with our emotions, we take everything on the chin, you know. In modern day society, that's not really the case, is it? And you know, it's something that's very important.
Absolutely, and it's even something that is in the news and maybe we should keep in mind. It's, of course, a lot of people are going to be suffering symptoms of with mental health issues, whatever they may be, during this COVID crisis and the issues that go with being locked in and suffering with financial uncertainty and job status, etc. But actually, FIFPro found that the number of footballers showing depression symptoms have doubled during this shutdown. So 13% of male players that they of the 1,134 male players that they surveyed were reporting symptoms consistent with a diagnosis of depression, which is quite stark, actually. And the Telegraph are even reporting that England players are among the footballers who are using mental health services during the coronavirus crisis. So, like, this, with the story that's being told here, and I think actually it was the Baldwins that were used to tell the story of the financial insecurity that players suffer earlier in the season. And again, the Baldwins are being used quite well here to show us the other side and the more difficult side of football, and often the side that we forget, because you think, oh, he's just out in the grass every day, what a great life he must be living. But the truth is that it's not that easy being in the limelight, dealing with it. You're living on a knife edge based on your performances for 90 minutes every few weekends, or in the case of Baldwin now, based on the performances of other people, because he's going to get dropped.
Yeah, certainly. I think just overall, they're very, very good, as you say, like kind of a device to give that some sort of body within the show. And it's very good to see kind of broadly that kind of, as Nick was talking about, more broad tropes of intergenerational leveling up when it comes to this sort of thing. I think that there was this kind of horrible phrase, which I dislike, man up, which was used a lot in kind of the old generation, whereas now I think kind of talking about these things and them being out on the table and something that you don't kind of bottle up inside is definitely a very, very good thing. And especially, you know, as you mentioned, with the current context, it's definitely something which you know, people need to be talking about more and more. Anyway, anything else? Right. Okay. But I mean, in this game, just to move on, our other man, Tom Flanagan, does give us a cathartic moment as he scores the goal against Portsmouth, actually, the bane of Sunderland in this entire kind of series. And there's a proper kind of centre-back's header from a corner. And there's a very nice kind of overlay from him telling us, yeah, it's a precious season.
The people that you meet in Tesco, the people that you meet in town, that's the pressure. They spend all their money that they've got to come and watch you play. That's pressure.
Unfortunately, the pressure tells on Sunderland. It's another draw, it's another 1-1. And we go straight into another game. God, there's so many. The fans who have journeyed to Fleetwood pick up on the theme.
I had no faith in them at all. Too many draws.
Oh, the draws.
And they lose, ultimately, here, actually. And the angry fans, Wearsiders, who are swearing, leaving the game, underline the dissatisfaction here with the team and how it's going. I mean, or maybe we're still seeing the after threats of Maggio leaving. But I mean, they ended up with an astonishing 19 draws that season, the most of any club. What do we think about this?
At the end of the day, it's by nature of drawing, you're one goal off winning a game. And if you've got a very good striker there, the likes of a Josh Maggio, who was clearly just quality above a League One, then yeah, you're going to get there. And of course, that was the massive gamble that Stuart Donald made, getting in with Greg for a league record, as it was at the time. But I would definitely put it into the effects of Maggio. But at the other side of things, it might be a lack of invention or dynamism on the part of Jack Ross as well. And that's something that I think the ownership definitely feel. And maybe that's them trying to exonerate themselves for the Greg deal, and it maybe not paying off to the extent that they would have wished for. But 19 draws, that's excessive, especially when you've only lost 5, which is less than any other club in the division.
Yeah, certainly there's an emphasis on not losing rather than winning. From the school of David Moyes, it seems, Jack Ross. I mean, you just mentioned it. Like, do we come back to that failure of Greg to step up? I mean, as we mentioned on that episode as well, no other option was signed because they just went headlong for Will Grigg when they meant to get 2 strikers. Wyke only managed 6 goals. I mean, there are loads of issues. There are loads of kind of instances of game winners being really important. I did have a look at Maggio, and actually, they drew more after he left than before he left. They had 9 draws after Maggio left in January. There were 10 before. He was an important player, but not actually a match winner. He only scored 2 match-winning goals, once against Bristol Rovers in December and once against Blackpool in January. So I think maybe there was an element that maybe the creativity in the team was what the issue was, rather than Maggio leaving. Nonetheless, it's definitely true that having a player who's able to put those chances away is still really, really important. A good example is Danny Ings this season for Southampton. His interventions are slated to have won them at least 18 more points than they otherwise would have had. A player like that is very, very important. And Maggio leaving, I think, still hasn't had an effect in terms of Greg not being able to replace.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like with Maggio leaving, it kind of fell onto Aidan McGeady's shoulders a little bit to be that match winner, to be that talismanic player within the team. And you did see from his performances that he did add an extra spark to the team, especially, I think you noticed it, a couple of the games where he couldn't play because he had an injury, or was getting injections with painkillers, then he came off the bench and they went 1-0 up in the playoff matches later on in the episode. I definitely feel like, you know, you need that sort of talismanic figure if you're going to succeed. And in some of those games that we watched, some of these draws, clearly there wasn't a player that was stepping up in Maggio's absence, even though, you know, there were a few players in the team that kind of showed elements of, key players. I think McGeady, perhaps in the Carabao Cup run as well, was critical to a couple of those victories. Checkatrade Trophy run.
In that Checkatrade Trophy final, it was definitely something that was focused on at the time, was Jack Ross's negativity in terms of trying to hold on to his lead. But first of all, actually, the way that he had set out the team in the first place in terms of stacking the midfield with more defensive talent because they lost against that opposition, which was Portsmouth again? Yeah. Because they'd already lost to Portsmouth earlier in the season, and so they were just stacking the midfield in a bid to try and negate their attack rather than, as they say, just trying to win. And in that game, they'd even had a good start and didn't build on it. And I think that seems to have been a story that played out throughout Sunderland's season. And at that rate, you do wonder if it's, especially given that they did bring in a new striker and they weren't able to get him into the game, whether or not he was taking his chances. There is a question over the management.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like this episode's really the first time as well that you really see the fans turn on Jack Ross. Over the course of the series, you haven't really seen it from the fans abusing him, but after the 2-1 defeat against Fleetwood, I think, you do see the fans sort of, you know, hurling abuse at the camera, filming the documentary, you know, swearing about Jack Ross and how he has to go and some other expletives. And the whole defensive mindset that we see over the course of the series does deserve some criticism, at least.
We'll discuss it properly a little bit later on, but I think an awful lot of that comes down to the fact that the fans have had their expectations built by the fact that they've had £4 million spent on a striker. Results haven't turned around. They've pretty much continued as they were, and they've just slowly slipped further down the table, so that, you know, that the fact of the matter is that they weren't in with a chance of getting into the automatic promotion places with the final game week of the season. They needed to win their 3 final games to even have a hope, and they weren't able to do that, obviously, with the Fleetwood game and the draw previous to that.
Yeah, they weren't very good. And also, I don't know if any of you guys spotted, but during that Portsmouth game, when Tom Flanagan's giving his voiceover, you actually see Will Grigg on the bench. So he's not even on the pitch, which is quite interesting as well. I do think that there's definitely an element of he's playing Wyke and he's not... I mean, Aidan McGeady to Jack Ross, in Jack Ross' defence, does seem like he's been carrying an injury for an awfully long time. But yeah, it's just... For whatever reason, like their results really fell off a cliff towards the end of the season. I mean, really fell off a cliff. It just wasn't very good. And for whatever reason, they just couldn't get going. They had a nice little run kind of the end of February, the start of March, but they won a succession of games and they just started drawing and losing and drawing. And for whatever reason, Jack Ross doesn't seem to be able to turn it around. He's sort of fallen at the final hurdle.
And it is something we would often discuss with Premier League teams when they're playing in Europe, especially on Thursday nights in the Europa League. It kind of becomes a bit of an obsession for us after a while. But as it was, because they made it to the playoff final, they played 61 games that season. That is a huge amount of games. And like we've seen plenty of very good Premier League teams lose their legs around April because of the fact that they've played too many games. Not to mind a squad like Sunderland that was completely stripped and rebuilt at the start of the year and so probably didn't have the depth that maybe it could have had. They wanted more strikers for a start, but it seems like throughout the team, it's the same players featuring week in, week out, apart from the little bit of rotation for the likes of the Luke O'Nines of this world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, having that checker trade trophy run was not without its risks and the risk of fatigue, which we often speak about, you know, the likes of Wolves and things like that in the Europa League in the past have definitely kind of been seen, I guess, with the impacts on Sunderland. And, you know, it does mean, because of this outcome, it's the lowest position the club has ever finished. And Tony Davidson, TD to Nick, says that he's hoping the fans are going to stay patient and not turn.
What I don't want to see is the fans turn. We don't want Stuart to not be able to walk down the street because he gets grief from fans, or me for that matter.
And we see a scene as well in Sunderland with Charlie, which is quite interesting. So he's deciding the comm strategy with Oscar Chamberlain, who's head of media. And he seems to have a little bit of self-doubt for the first time, I think, this whole series.
I just feel for the first time like whatever I'm doing it's not hasn't quite worked.
That's quite interesting. They decide, like, you know, to go for a call, this call to action theme on the comms. But why do you think they include this little moment where it seems like Charlie's lost a little bit of the poise that he seems to have had throughout the campaign?
It's just a kind of realistic interpretation of what's going on with Charlie. You know, the pressure perhaps has finally got to him. He's been relatively positive. It's all been about ticket sales, but, you know, this time round, they're not able to flog the tickets in the same manner that they have, and they seem to be starting to lose the support. And it's the most critical juncture of the season, so it's almost a bit of a surprise to see that the ticket sales are so down compared to where they would be, and perhaps that's indicative of the poor form in their most recent home games. And perhaps, you know, you see it on Football Manager where the morale's abysmal or very low from your players after a couple of defeats, and maybe Charlie's feeling a little bit of the effects of that morale as well.
There are two aspects to that, I guess, and it's Andrew Camus points out the fact that for season ticket holders, they actually have to pay to attend that playoff semi-final leg at the Stadium of Light. That's part of the league rules, and so no matter what, a lot of them will be saving money to go down to London to get the train, to stay overnight, to go to that match. And so some people are just reticent to go to this playoff semi-final based on that. Then there is the other side of it with the fact that, look, form abysmal, morale abysmal, and someone like Charlie Methven recognises maybe that the tide is turning against him and the management of the club. And maybe it's also a sign that he's actually managing to find his people within the club, that they've gutted all the naysayers and the people that were he wasn't able to work with. And now he actually has somebody that he trusts that he can discuss with. And maybe that's actually a sign of an achievement on his part that we're just kind of seeing in a different light. Because earlier in the year, we saw him asking an awful lot of questions and getting basically no answers.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really interesting is that this emphasises the difference between business and football, because like football fans aren't workers. They won't always go no matter what. Like a worker will always show up to work no matter what kind of bad morale or bad form has been going on in the team. But football fans aren't the same. They're able to exercise a semblance of choice about that. And you can't motivate fans with the stick, which is his go-to. Like we saw internally that he was talking about redundancies continuing if bad form was to continue in terms of the revenues.
The cost cutting will accelerate and more people lose their jobs.
And it feels like he's kind of running out of tools almost as positivity siphons off. I mean, that's what I kind of took from it there. It was just he was struggling to continue to apply like his methodologies now that positive sheen had gone and all that kind of stuff about, as you mentioned, them having to pay to go to this game on top of what they'd already paid for. It just felt like, you know, he was really struggling and scrabbling around for something to do, some sort of magic way to sort things out. But it really felt, yeah, it did really feel like the end of an empire to some extent. I don't know why. Just kind of got that feel.
Shoot me down if you think I'm wrong on this, though. So this is really the third time that we've seen him trying to sell something. At the start, he was trying to sell the vision of the club to within the club, basically, and maybe to fans through podcasts, etc. We didn't really see any pushback from fans. If anything, we saw them buying into very kind of cliched, just basic steps that the management took that were being bought into. Grand, and then the staff, they were against him, and sure, he had to use the stick, but also he showed plenty of being able to use carrot to attract fans on for that Boxing Day, December 26th, Stephen's Day game, whatever you want to call it. He certainly nailed that, like completely nailed that, and definitely worked the staff in terms of getting people in the door and stuff. Now, you might say that the people that he was trying to attract that day were money spenders. They're the types of people that he would know from London, let's say. He was talking about the expats, as he called them, that lived down south that were coming up north for Christmas. Maybe he just doesn't understand the types of people that he's trying to get to fork out now. The season ticket holders who live in Sunderland every day, the people who just, you know, just love football. Maybe these are the most foreign people of all to Charlie Methven.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he does kind of talk about how, in the last episode especially, he talked about how he kind of got the sympathy for the North. I think he kind of had that, maybe a couple of episodes before as well, he said that, you know, Sunderland fans had come full circle and started to kind of think, oh, you know, we do actually have some shared values.
Some of the Sunderland fans who I've got to know a bit better have said, for Southerners, Stuart and I seem quite down to earth.
But yeah, it comes back to what I was saying about, for whatever reason, it just seems like it's not working now. Yeah, that's interesting too.
Yeah, it does feel like the approach they're going for here is to stick with the fans. It's almost like, you know, we're in war now. You've got to do your duty. You know, you must come to the game and support the team because that's your civic duty, is to come to the ground. That's almost the approach they're going for. And yeah, it does feel like he's lost his a little bit of his joie de vivre in terms of trying to inspire the fans to come along to the game. And that might be off the back of some of the recent performances, as I suggested.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, speaking of losing the joie de vivre, we swapped to Stuart in Oxford. And his partner, Laura, is saying it's very difficult to deal with the social media trolling of him. We have this kind of contrived semi-argument with him and her. You know, he's saying, you know, standing with the fans is the best way to watch football. So she, you know, he doesn't have to own the club to enjoy that experience. But he feels, you know, it's going to be okay to own. But he does portentously say about next year that it's not going to be very good if I don't go up.
If we don't go up, if you think this year has been, you've seen me stressed, then wait for next year.
It just feels like telegraphing at this point, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like they've given up trying to kind of keep you on tenterhooks. You know what's going to happen. But an important point here, I suppose, is that we spoke about mental health for the players and when you can criticise. We've been a bit scathing about Stuart throughout this series. From the beginning, we kind of, oh, he's quite a genuine guy. But kind of as events kind of transpired, especially with the Grigg incident, we kind of did criticise a little bit. Where's the line with him, do we think? I mean, is it different to the players in terms of critique and that professional versus personal thing I was talking about? Because, I mean, with the guy kind of owning the club and putting kind of himself and his pride on the line, like, it's very difficult to not kind of trespass into the personal, isn't it, when you're criticising him or at least kind of talking negatively about his decisions?
I guess at the end of the day, the nature of his job is that you are talking about his judgment as a human being. You're talking about how he decides to spend his money, what his personal and maybe you could say like economic priorities are, which means you inherently end up commenting on the person more rather than, let's say, the player more. Like you could be talking about Shakhar and Mustafi, but you're never going to be talking about his views on anything, usually anyway. You're just talking about the fact that he missed a header, could have been in a better position, played someone onside, whatever it might be. So at the end of the day, you are obviously going to be dealing with the personal more closely very quickly, but at the end of the day, what's okay and what's not is no different in my eyes. You know, the line still exists in the same way.
Yeah, exactly. You're treading you're treading a fine line. Obviously, probably some of the abuse that he saw on Twitter or his wife saw on Twitter would have been over that line, no doubt. And we would, again, probably say it's probably very highly offensive and unnecessary and, you know, just has no place in the world. But, you know, obviously when on the same point, when we're talking about him on this podcast and some of the decisions he made, he's opened himself up to criticism in that regard, because obviously he's made a number of financial decisions over the course of his tenure at Sunderland, some of them sensible, some of them not so sensible, such as the Will Grigg one, which we've been highly critical of on that podcast, because we felt it was obviously a waste of money and he spent too much money, and that was his business decision, that was his personal decision, and he's opened himself up to those criticisms. But I think you do have a little bit of sympathy for him in this scene. I did feel sorry for him, and I felt sorry for, obviously, you know, no one wants to read horrible things being read about himself. You know, he's obviously got honourable intentions, hasn't he? When it comes to trying to run the club, and I did notice that again when you went to the away match and he was kind of with the crowd and everything in the playoff semi-final, you did feel that, you know, he does have this the club's best interests at heart, doesn't he? And he's made some mistakes, but you don't want to see too many criticisms.
No, he does seem a genuine chap. He just doesn't seem to realise his limitations, or at least the way in which he's been portrayed. But yeah, I think Nick's summed up very nicely that you don't obviously don't want to see it, that sort of horrible stuff written about him, do you? But I mean, despite everything, I do kind of have that pang of sympathy. It's just quite. It's not the best, is it? It really isn't the best. Anyway, ahead of the last home game, we see Charlie thanking the ticket office staff, and we see the beginning of the playoff semis. The playoffs will be kind of the duration of the show, the rest of the show. And the semis are versus nemesis Portsmouth. There's some talking heads about the importance of the game from our mates Andrew Camus and Joyce the Cook. Into the game, Sunderland without McGeady, edge of a tight encounter 1-0. Straight into the return, it's 0-0. Stuart gives a vox pop after the game, and his passion and authenticity really come through.
You know, that's what being a football fan's about. You know, we're surrounded by them all. We're all in the same boat. Everyone's watching their watch for about 20 minutes. Time doesn't go very quick, but we got there.
We learn that it's Charlton who they'll play, and Nick Barnes is saying they won't win. They show Mickey Gray missing a penalty in 1988. Then we see the build-up to the game itself, charting the journey of a couple of fans on the train, you know, and the fans take over Trafalgar Square again. They're in Covent Garden last episode, but you know, same thing. And they're taking it up to the game itself. Not going to narrate over the whole scene here, except to say that, as expected, Sunderland lose 2-1 with a Charlton goal in the final minute of the game. A moment of painful gravity as Sunderland's consignment to the third tier for another season is realised. We see the impact on the fans, all manner of them. Andrew's kid in tears and Ian and Michelle gutted. Jack says they didn't deserve to lose so harshly.
We'll have to dust ourselves down over the coming weeks, but right now there's a rawness of emotion that is very sore.
And Laura gives a crestfallen Stuart a huge hug. Charlie half-heartedly clinks a toast to next season. As Stuart Lees, a fan, asks, are we ever going to be good, mate? It's the eighth time in a row since the FA Cup win in 1973 they've lost at Wembley. It's really quite a dramatic turn of events, because they ended up with nothing when they could have had it all at the risk of sounding like Adele. Were they just unlucky? You know, the fine margins in football are really exposed here, aren't they?
I think with regards to the two of them, I think, yeah, for sure there's the fine margins of football shown, because at the end of the day, if they had been promoted, 90% of their sins would have been forgiven. But in the context of how the series presents it, I think that realistically you've got to say that Charlie's pretty much nailed his role, whereas Stuart Donald, of course, the questions come up, and we've been through quite a lot of them even on this episode with Greg, with Maja, with just in general his philosophy and whether he should have followed it or not. And that's the difficulty when it comes to trying to look back on these things, that no matter what, we're going to just look back on, did they get promoted? Because financially, they're screwed when they don't get promoted, no matter what. They couldn't plan financially because of that all season long, because they find performance-wise on the pitch, they just weren't good enough for them to know, okay, we're running away with it, or even just the other side of it, okay, we're just not good enough, we're going to be stuck down here for another year.
Yeah, exactly. And the guys say that much themselves. So we go back to Sunderland for the final scene. You see Charlie reflecting on the positive financial transformation.
In the space of 12 months, the club has gone from losing £20 million a year to break even. This club
cannot be in the third division of English football for 3 years.
And Stuart, who says football side could have been better, and reiterates he wants to stay on as long as the fans want him.
I won't outstay my welcome. The fans will tell me, and I'll stay as long as they want me to.
And you know, as Stag said, it's really interesting to think about the two of them, and obviously think a bit more in terms of having the fans' view when Alex comes on next week. But I mean, it is worth kind of talking about kind of how they both see things, because it seems like Charlie's claiming success, gotten down to break even, whereas Stuart, it just looks like he's kind of, to some extent, admitting that it's not really worked out how they wanted to. And yes, if they'd gotten promoted, whatever happened would have been forgiven. But it really is a case of kind of off-the-pitch success or kind of back-office success to some extent happening whilst on the pitch they fell short. How do we feel about them both as the series draws to a close?
They failed ultimately in their job. What they set out to deliver at the beginning of the season was to achieve promotion for the club. But how much of that is their responsibility and how much of that responsibility falls into the management and Jack Ross is open to interpretation and debate as owners, you know, as Stuart. Obviously, Charlie, in terms of what his responsibilities were in regards to cutting costs and you know, raising ticket sales and the profile of the club and you know, to reduce that deficit and end that piss-take party. In some regards, Charlie has actually been very successful in what he set out to achieve at the beginning of the season. So that is, as Tom said, that is what some sort of success of the back room. But on the pitch and what Stuart was kind of, you know, trying to get for the club in terms of, you know, hiring the manager, they picked Jack Ross. That was their selection. So they have obviously some responsibility there in terms of who they even selected as the manager and the transfer policy as well. Obviously in the January transfer window, what happened with Maggio and Will Grigg falls firmly on Stuart Donald's shoulders, and to blame Jack Ross, it kind of feels a bit churlish based on what we saw on camera where he said he wasn't worth it and not worth the money. So in that regard, Stuart does open himself up to criticism, as I said, and there has been some failure in that respect.
So I think I'm going to largely echo what Nick said, so I'll be rather brief on this. But Charlie, I think, has pretty much nailed his stated objectives as they were put out and as the series portrays it. Like, did he fill the stadium at Christmas and get in that big gate? Yeah. Did he annoy people along the way? Yeah, but he did clear out the staff and he got seemingly his people. There doesn't need to be anywhere near as much aggro on that side as the series paints it towards the end. He's not responsible for the football stuff, not his issue. But he seems to have had his heart in the right place. He seems to have, I think, actually kind of come to settle on the club as well and come to love the place for what it is. And he's not feuding within himself about the job. Stuart Donald seems to be the complete opposite. And he seems to have kind of realised that financially he just doesn't have the muscle to do this, and that he's probably jumped into a pool he can't swim in. He's not stuck to his principles on how a club should be run. He's got, like, you know, left the blood rush to his head when it came to that Grigg deal, and when he took the initiative there, he mishandled transfer planning in general. And if he's going to now try to offload the blame for that Grigg thing onto Jack Ross, I think what he's got to consider is whether, if he thinks that Jack Ross wasn't getting the best out of his £4 million signing, and it was March and the form was starting to dip, at that point, does the responsibility lie with Stuart Donald for not taking extreme executive action yet again and actually just getting rid of Jack Ross? Like, I know he'll say that was absolutely mental when he's got them that far through the season, but I feel when Stuart Donald has undermined him to the extent that he did, I think he's probably got to deal with the situation as it develops because of what he did.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think we'll talk with Alex next week about who's to blame ultimately in more detail. But just to say, obviously, I probably would echo both your points. And I think it's almost like the physical reality linked with the perceptive reality as well. Like, Charlie is in Sunderland. He's in Black Cat House. That's where he works when we watch him. He's there when business happens. Stuart isn't. He's in his office in Oxfordshire. And I think the contrast is always clear there. I do think they gave it a good go. I don't think they came with sinister kind of motives or anything. And I also think kind of it's fairly sympathetic in terms of how it shot to the two of them. Like, we spoke about it the last couple of weeks about how they've been kind of eaten up by the system, and how Stuart especially actually found it, I think, very, very difficult to hold fast to those principles of it being the old-fashioned way. But, I mean, it really is that huge Grigg decision, as Nick mentioned, which damns them on so many levels. Like, not signing another option there, the signing of a striker who doesn't fit the system. And, you know, it just really seems to me to be that's where the responsibility lies ultimately. It feels like The Apprentice, doesn't it? Who's responsible for the failing of this task? But I think that's really, where I'll go with it for now. And then we'll see what Alex's views are next week. So I'm sure they'll be a bit more insightful. But yeah, I mean, the final word of the season is given to the fans who hope that Sunderland will see a great, big, beautiful tomorrow.
Apart from my family, Sunderland's my next love. You know, and that's it.
So, did we like this episode, guys?
I think as a way of ending the series, I thought it brought all the threads together quite well. And I guess it did harken back to what we've just discussed. It did get to the bottom of the fact that at the end of the day, it's the football that matters, be that to the fans, and that's what they love, and it's the club that they love, but also to the backroom team, that their success is so contingent on the football. And so maybe that's the greater point to take from it. But just look, it's obviously a difficult end to a difficult season, but it is a good episode and it relays it quite well.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like the episode rounded the series off quite nicely. We experienced yet again the heartache for the Sunderland fans that we had at the end of season one when they went down. This time it was losing in the playoff final. Very much sort of fits the theme of the series, which is doom and gloom, sadly, but along with the sort of the theme tune music that kind of has this sort of, you know, sort of depressing vibe, even though it's an amazing song. So I thought it was a good end to the series, and really good series of television as well. And as I said before, probably the best TV football documentary that I've watched.
Yeah, certainly. I think the episode itself was very good. There was a lot of games that they had to get through, a lot of seminal games. I think they accomplished it very, very well. And as Stag said, I think they definitely brought all the threads together and were able to kind of provide some sort of conclusion. But I mean, it does leave you kind of wondering what happened next. And I kind of feel a bit sad about it being the last scheduled series. There was an interview with a producer and they said, never say never, but they'll be back in the future. But this season was not kind of filmed. 2019-20, it wasn't filmed in the same way the other seasons were, which is a bit sad. I mean, how do you guys feel about this being the last scheduled series?
It's obviously disappointing to hear, because, you know, we kind of want to follow the path and see what happens again, and you know, how the club deals with deals with coronavirus, for instance, would be very, very good television.
I mean, I'm certainly interested to see what happened next, and I think that's a good point again to reiterate that next week we'll be joined by Alex McCain, who's the host of the Roker Report, to kind of just talk about the season as a whole. So I mean, we've given a little bit of our thoughts about Stuart and a little bit of our thoughts about Charlie, etc. But I think it'd be good to talk about last season through the eyes of a fan, and using that perspective to hopefully give a more rounded view of kind of what happened. Think about earlier on this podcast, we spoke about what a fan brings to the occasion as well as kind of us as distance analysts, and provide an epilogue. I mean, we'll look into it as well now, and there has been some news just kind of this week actually about Sunderland and what's going on. But have a look into where are they now and kind of what's happened since the Sunderland. I think this whole series has been quite a bit fun, hasn't it, guys? I mean, have you enjoyed doing the watch-alongs? It's a little bit different from our usual fare, and obviously we're hoping our usual fare does come back soon. Have to try to think about what the hell we do after this, but yeah, it's been fun, hasn't it?
It's been good fun. It's something different to what we've been previously known for, but I've found it fun to do. Cool, yeah. Good to branch out and try new things as well in terms of podcasting, so yeah, definitely enjoyable.
Yeah, I think for me as well, I binged the whole entire series before we had actually decided to ever do a watch along to it. I had the whole entire thing watched, and on a second viewing I think I maybe artistically enjoyed the series more. I think the first time around I was just extremely story driven, didn't really pick up on maybe the finer details, and when you watch it again you definitely see what, like, there's some real actual like creativity going into the making of this. It's not just merely a timeline of the season with, you know, cameras just sticking in every part of the club at every moment. They've actually put this together really well. They've it ties through nicely with the first season. There's themes running throughout it. It's just a really good series and a very good documentary. Like, I would compare it to, let's say, the Leeds one, which I thought was extremely weak, and even the City one just screamed of a certain type of bias. Like, the City one was interesting because it was City and the players that were in it. But, but apart from in that City documentary where Fabian Delph is talking about, you know, it's football, it's just basic, isn't it? And Guardiola, like, the CPU in his brain just fries, and he's like, no, it's not football. And he kind of freaks out that you don't actually get a huge insight into what goes on at that club, especially on the management side of it, which of course would be extremely interesting to hear about given the ongoing financial fair play issues that that club is having. So, you know, really enjoyed it.
Excellent. So, yeah, just to wrap this up and say who we are, you know who we are, but we are Who Got the Assist on Twitter at @WGTA_FPL, at @WGTA_Nick, and at @FPLStag, and on Instagram at WGTA.FPL.
And of course, as we've said before, we will indeed be back next week to talk about what happened next and to talk about the series and what it was like to be involved in it. So we'll be joined by Alex, the host of the Roker Report podcast. So looking forward to that. But until then, stay safe and stay alert as well, is the new advice. Yeah. Talk to you soon.
Exactly. Hope to see you watch London Sly Dive for the final time. Yeah, stay alert, people. See you soon.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.